Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the HMEB podcast. I'm your host, David Cuff, the executive editor of HME Business Magazine, your source for news, trends, and insights into the home medical equipment industry. This episode features an update on Quantum Rehab's iLevel, a wheelchair technology that's been gaining adoption by users and acceptance by payers. Now it's focused on its next big challenge, Medicare funding. After that, we'll talk to a well-known sleep provider about some strategies for getting sleep patients to better comply with their therapy and how the right equipment can help. Okay, let's dive in. Back on April 25th, you may have caught a story on HME-business.com or in eSource, our weekly e-newsletter, that iLevel, a special adjustable seat adjustable seat height technology from Pride Mobility Quantum Rehab, had gotten 25,000 users, which is a big deal considering how unique this technology is and also the unique funding circumstances in which this technology finds itself. Seeing those numbers, I felt it was a good point in time to talk about this technology. And here today, we have Seth Johnson, who is the Senior Vice President of Government Relations for Pride Mobility Products and Quantum Rehab. Seth, how you doing? Welcome.
I'm doing great, David.
All right.
Thank you today.
Fantastic. I am happy to have you here. So a lot of people might not necessarily have a clear idea of iLevel, and maybe that's a good place to start. Seth, could you kind of describe the iLevel technology for the audience?
Yeah, so iLevel technology is basically seat elevation technology that's able to be put on a power chair base. The Quantum iLevel goes on our Group 3 complex rehab base, and it is patented, patent pending the technology for safety, so you're able to allow the seat elevation technology to move at walking speed, fully elevated at 12 inches.
Yeah, it's really something. Somebody can be sitting in this chair, raise up the height, and then can go as fast, if I'm not mistaken, is it 4.5 miles per hour?
That's correct, yes. The individual is able to go 4.5 miles per hour.
And perfectly balanced, which is really something. The idea, at Medtrade Spring, a couple of years back when you were first introducing this, you had sort of an obstacle course with a ramps and a landing and stuff, and you let people try to negotiate this ramp system. And I mean, this chair fully raised up had perfect balance because of all these different sort of suspension controls and I guess motor controls that keep this thing perfectly balanced. It's hard to appreciate how robust this technology is. It's not just raising up a seat until you're actually sitting in it using the chair.
Great. Yeah, so the technology I mentioned earlier, we do have a patent on that, and the patent has to do with the suspension inhibitors that we put that allows for the individuals who use iLevel power chairs to be able to move at that 4.5 mile an hour speed safely. The other technology that's out there in the previous generations of technology have not allowed for individuals to move fully elevated or, you know, really elevated at all without going into what's known as creep mode, which has the power chair only allow for movement maybe a quarter mile an hour. It's very, very slow. And that's for safety reasons, because when you change the height of the seat, you're changing the weight and other mechanics of that power chair base, and in order for it to remain stable, certain things need to happen to allow the individual to remain safe, fully elevated, while moving and negotiating the various environments that they would, meet as they're going through their daily routines, whether it's on a sidewalk, going, just moving around in the home, crossing a threshold, going down a slight a decline in the home if there's a ramp.
Yeah.
To make the home more accessible. That's the benefit of this particular technology. One of the many benefits of this particular technology is that patented suspension inhibitor lockout. That's a core part of eye level.
And let's get into that to that life-changing nature of this technology, because we're talking about the technical innovation, right? Which is that you can negotiate these objects at a fairly decent clip. It's got this suspension control and all this other stuff, but the net result is something truly remarkable for the user.
Oh, it absolutely is life-changing for the user. And that's why, so many users are asking for this technology by name. They see others out there, in their community, on social media, that have this technology, and they see what it enables those individuals to do that they're unable to do right now. At a static seat-to-floor height, without the seat elevation technology, it's very limiting. One of the things that we, regularly hear from consumers once they are provided this technology or trial this technology is that it really more than doubles the functionality of the chair, because we, live in a three-dimensional world, and they've been forced prior to live in a based on a two-dimensional plane.
Yeah, and that's that really is it, that they're sort of limited to a specific height range. And that's that. But now, if they have some sort of seat elevation technology, they can raise up, they can have a quote unquote, eye level conversation with somebody. They can get something out of a cupboard. They can do all the sorts of things that have been hard, if not impossible, in their, in a standard, static seat height environment.
Absolutely. It really is life-changing and helps them more fully participate in their mobility-related activities of daily living, which is, one of the main reasons why many of the third-party payers will pay for this. The only one that will not consider it right now is Medicare.
And
we're working on that effort.
Yeah, let's dive into that. So you guys have private payers and even some state Medicaid programs that will fund this, or at least consider it for funding. Maybe you could kind of, let's start with the private payers. So there are private insurances out there that will cover eye level, correct?
That's absolutely correct, and we actually have a ticker. If you go to www.quantumrehab.com/eye level. There's actually a ticker that we have on there of all the payers where we've received, examples that they have paid for it.
That's awesome.
What we have heard is that, and what we have seen, in reality in the marketplace is that all the private payers will consider the technology for coverage. All the Medicaids will consider it for coverage. The Veterans Administration will cover and pay for this technology. The only payer that will not consider this for coverage is Medicare Part B. Even Medicare Advantage plans consider this technology for payment.
And I'm curious. So, what is the hang up there, Seth? Why is Medicare not considering this?
Well, Medicare has indicated that they don't believe that it meets the definition of DME. This technology does not meet the definition of DME because they don't believe it serves a medical purpose.
And we've
had multiple conversations with them on this. This is an issue that the Myositis Association originally brought to Medicare's attention way back in 2013, and then other consumer organizations have been working on this and meeting with Medicare since then to get them to do what's referred to as a benefit category determination, get them to review and revise their policy related to Medicare coverage of seat elevation for individuals using power wheelchairs.
And what's that association's position and your association's position regarding that? Obviously, you know, there's the life activity, aid to daily living sort of aspect of this. Is there some sort of clinical evidence also that shows that there's a benefit here?
Yes, there is. And there's various clinical studies. Georgia Tech University actually did a survey back last year, early last year. Actually, I think that started back in 2017. And then they were able to come up with their survey results in mid-2018. But they have undertaken this effort from a clinical perspective to try to, you know, talk to individuals. And they interviewed or heard from over 112, you know, respondents to a survey where they asked various questions regarding, you know, how often do they engage their seat elevation system? What are the primary things that they do throughout the day that their seat elevation system enables them to do? Most show that, the most significant reason why, according to this survey by Georgia Tech University, use this technology on a daily basis is to help reach things that could be reaching in the bathroom, in the kitchen, in various environments that they encounter throughout the day. It also significantly helps many with the ability to independently transfer to their wheelchair from the bed, from their wheelchair to a seat, etc. So, you know, being able to use gravity and being able to elevate higher than the obstacle or the particular piece of furniture that you're looking to transfer to, you know, really makes it much easier to independently transfer that you're just simply not able to do, or, you know, you're at high risk of injury if you attempt to do it without the technology, without being able to be elevated above the item that you're looking to transfer to.
Uh-huh. You know, this is really interesting because it sure sounds to me like if you have more independent users, that this might actually have a cost upside to the payer because there might be less assistance required to fund or things like that. Am I going out on a limb there?
I don't think you are going out on a limb, and this is something that has been raised by the consumer organizations, and we have certainly articulated this as well in our discussions with Medicare and others on this topic. You know, the cost effectiveness of this technology, I just talked about how this enables individuals to reach and to independently transfer. Many individuals with complex medical conditions need caregivers to assist them throughout the day, not all day, but multiple times during the day. And many times it's to help, you know, get them out of bed, get them dressed, and get them ready for their day. And then the same at night. Some need, you know, meal assistance, and, you know, some need much more assistance than that. So the consumer groups have been indicating that, you know, when you look at the average salary of one of these caregivers, let's just say it's $10 an hour, which is on the low side. If you're able to reduce that caregiver need by 5 hours a week, and, you know, there's 7 hours in a day, so 5 hours a week is, you know, very low average. But let's say you were able to eliminate 5 hours a week of a caregiver. So you take that $10 an hour, 5 hours a week, that's, you know, $2,600 a year. That's more than this technology would cost the Medicare program and these other payers who are considering this.
Not a small amount.
No, it's not. It's not.
So what's the next step here, Seth? Is it just continuing to try and influence Medicare and to show Medicare that there are other corners of American healthcare that are already funding this and hopefully create some momentum? Is that sort of the angle?
Yeah, well, there's been significant discussions with Medicare. The ITEM Coalition, which is a conglomerate umbrella organization of 72 or so consumer organizations, national consumer organizations in Washington, D.C., have really taken the lead on pursuing this benefit category determination with Medicare in order to provide for coverage and consideration of this technology as a part of the prior authorization process within Medicare. So you know, they're continuing to have discussions with senior Medicare officials. I actually met with some senior officials in Baltimore earlier in the year with a colleague on the clinical side and a consumer. And, you know, they said, you know what? We have what we need in Baltimore. This is a decision that, you know, is being discussed at the administrator level. So we do feel like, you know, we've made significant progress in this effort with Medicare to get them to realize how this does serve a medical purpose, how, you know, they're truly the only payer out there that will not consider this for coverage. And, you know, we're extremely hopeful that as we move through this year, Medicare will make it a decision that, you know, they will consider this for payment. It's not going to be guaranteed. We don't believe that, you know, we'll ever be in a place where it will be guaranteed. It's always going to come down to the medical justification for the technology and what is the individual able to do with the technology that they're unable to do without it. And if it helps them more fully participate in their mobility-related activities of daily living, then Medicare and all the other payers should be paying for this, especially if it's going to save them additional dollars as they're looking to control and manage the healthcare costs of Medicare beneficiaries.
Gotcha. All right. Well, this is fascinating stuff. It's obviously an unfolding story. Everybody out there, make sure to follow it on hme-business.com and again on our eSource e-newsletter. And obviously our sister publication, Mobility Management, which is mobilitymgmt.com. It will be covering it as well. And Seth, on your side, if listeners want to find out more about the technology and about your progress with it, where can they go?
They can go to www.quantumrehab.com/eyelevel.
That sounds way too hard, Seth.
quantumrehab.com/eyelevel.
All right. Well, Seth, thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to kind of update us on this.
Great to be with you today, David.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye. Thanks again to Seth. Now we're going to travel across the spectrum of home medical equipment, all the way from complex rehab over to sleep therapy, where we'll learn from a longtime sleep provider about how to increase sleep therapy patient compliance. I'm here talking with Gary Sheehan, the president and CEO of Cape Medical Supply in Cape Cod, Mass, about sleep therapy compliance and particularly about mask comfort. Gary, how are you?
I'm doing great, David. How are you?
Fine. I'm glad to talk to you. So let's hear a little bit about your sleep therapy business. I think you mentioned that 80% of your business is sleep. This is obviously the cornerstone of Cape Medical Supply.
Yeah, no, you nailed it. We're based here on Cape Cod. We operate in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and Maine, and really have had a strategic focus on scaling our sleep therapy business over the past 8 years, and it does now comprise 80% of our total revenue, and the other 20% is orthopedic bracing. So we've really narrowed down our focus and walked out of certain parts of the market that we don't think are functional from a reimbursement point of view at this point. And really happy with the program we've got in place and continuing to try and add volume and make changes that are beneficial for the patients and referral partners that we're, you know, so proud to serve.
Yeah. And so looking at all these sleep patients, obviously, as you've worked to focus your business, I'm sure what you found is that one, there's a steady supply of OSA patients, and two, that probably no two sleep patients are the same.
Yeah, sleep is a very personal experience, obviously, and we all have our own habits and traits and things that that we take to the bed every night, and it's important for our clinicians to get into that with our patients and understand what their sleep patterns and habits are, and you know how they breathe, and really get to understand what we can about their sleep and about their body, so we can fit them most appropriately. Sleep is a very local business still. There is a need to be in front of a patient and see them and talk to them about all these things. And we've got, thankfully, a really good team of professionals that does that every day across the four states that we provide service in.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's a big territory. So what about these sleep patients and compliance? What's the number one concern
or sort of bullet point that you see when it comes to ensuring that these patients comply with their sleep therapy?
Yeah, it's mask fit. I think it always has been and always will be. That is the part of the therapy that physically touches their face. And if there's something wrong or amiss with the fit of that mask on that patient's face, there's almost nothing else that can be done aside from refitting or switching out the mask. So getting the mask fit right at first pass, we continue to believe is the key to unlocking the highest compliance rates possible. I think second to that is really broader engagement from the patients. I think there's been some interesting studies by the manufacturers about the utilization of their apps, and patients who utilize the apps have a much higher overall compliance rate. So I think ensuring that patients understand how severe obstructive sleep apnea is as a clinical condition, how important it is for them to treat it, and getting them deeply engaged right at the outset of therapy and bought in that this is going to help them is a real close second to that mask fit in achieving the highest compliance rates possible.
Gotcha. Well, let's actually flip the conversation for a second and talk about engagement before diving into mask fit. So I think you kind of gave a quick kind of top tier underscoring of how engagement is important when it comes to compliance. But let's dive in there. When patients come to you initially after being diagnosed with OSA, how do you foster that engagement? Because I would imagine that they don't quite get how serious it is, as you mentioned.
Yeah, so the best partnerships that we have, the patients are well educated before they come to us. So we have partnerships with labs and medical practices and integrated healthcare systems across the region, and those where they have a level of engagement with their physician, lab tech, etc., prior to even coming to us is where we find the best results, because that patient is now primed for involvement with us. Whereas, other situations, we just get a fax and, we call the patient and the patient says, "Now what? Okay, I remember doing the test, but I never got the results. What do I do?" So there's, that confusion. And then we've got a much longer runway of teaching that type of patient what OSA is, what CPAP is, how their life is going to look on CPAP, how we work with the insurance company to drive compliance so they can keep it. There's all that discussion that has to happen. But when they come to us and they don't really understand OSA or understand their test results, we're working an uphill battle at that point. So it's really important for the referring community to have that dialogue with patients as they're going through the diagnostic process. That's where we find the most success with patients.
Gotcha, is when the referral community is on board.
Yes, exactly. When they've engaged the patient prior to just sending a referral. So we do see that, as I described before, the sort of pitching of information over the wall, right? We just get something, we call the patient, and there's been no level of engagement with the patient. So that is not ideal.
And when you work with the referral community, are there ways that you can help them help you educate and sort of onboard those sleep patients?
Yeah, I mean, we have worked on some handoff. It's a handoff in care, and we have worked with certain providers to have them physically give the patient something that sort of describes what's going to happen. That's an ongoing issue, though. We think we can do a better job there. It can be hard to convince the referral community of their role in this. They sort of see their role as just handing off to us, and that is accurate. We pick it up and we handle prior auth and everything else, but it's just the messaging that goes along with the handoff that could be improved and could be much more valuable.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, that's, I think that's a perennial a topic for just about any provider of any type of DME is how can they get the referral partners to help out in the process. So let's switch back now to mask comfort and getting the right mask fit and all that good stuff. So you've got a patient, they've been reasonably onboarded, or perhaps they're a super patient and they are totally engaged and ready to go. What do you do to start figuring out like the right mask format, fit? What's the sort of process that you go through that you think makes a difference?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's all about that conversation that our clinician has with the patient, in talking about how they sleep and how they breathe during their sleep and all that stuff. So mm-hmm. it really is a human to human conversation. We do think and are looking at sort of some question sets that could help that. I do think there is sort of a formula to it. In the future, I think that there's going to be some development in this space. But right now, it really is a dialogue between the clinician and the patient about all their sleep habits and patterns, and an evaluation of their the shape of their face and things like that that gets to that best fit.
Gotcha. And explain to me going through the different sorts of formats, because we've got, nasal pillows, over the nose, full face, all these different sorts of masks. How is that all determined by face shape and sleeping habits, or are there other factors at play?
That's the majority of it. And again, I'm not a clinician, so I would defer to our clinical team on everything that goes into fitting. But yeah, it really is that discussion and evaluation by a skilled, trained professional that gets to that best fit and best longer term outcome for the patients.
And I'm curious. So you've got the patient. They think they figured out the right format. They think they figured out the right fit. The patient goes home, starts their therapy. Is there tweaking that happens afterwards?
Yeah, there's a whole telehealth play here around the outreach that we're doing and the coaching and intervention that happens, particularly throughout the first 90 days. So yeah, there's definitely an ongoing, there's certain patients that go home and self-manage and they have great, really good results. There's others who need more handholding, and that's what we're here to do. That's the value that we deliver to the healthcare system, and that's what certain patients rely on to help gain compliance and receive the real benefit of sleep therapy.
Gotcha. Are there any things that you see your fellow sleep providers doing wrong when it comes to mask fit? Or getting the right mask? Since you've been focused on this business so tightly, I'm curious, have you seen sort of learning curves that you've already surmounted that other providers might be going through?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know because this happens in a closed door environment. So I mean, we do think that we've figured out a really good systemic way to fit patients for multiple masks to drive the best outcome, but it's hard to know. I think a lot of how providers fit and evaluate patients is sort of proprietary, and it's hard to know what they may or may not be doing right or wrong.
Well, on the flip side, do you have any pro tips that you might be willing to share? Perhaps not the entire secret sauce, but some key things that you think providers ought to be doing.
I think it's listening, right? I think it's listening and understanding of how patients sleep and breathe at night, and that sometimes could involve spousal or partner discussion as well. We don't always, we might think we sleep a certain way, but we're asleep. So do we really know?
So it's a
listening and understanding activity really. And to me too, it's consistency. So you shouldn't have, 10 therapists fitting and evaluating patients 10 different ways. There has to be some formula or science to the way that you go about these fittings. Otherwise, you're going to deal with disparate outcomes, right? You're going to have certain patient population pools that have really good results, others that have really bad results, and that could be a function of different therapists going about things a different way. So listening, understanding, and consistency, I think, would be the three buckets I would focus on there.
That's great right there. What about elements external to the mask? I imagine there are several, but if you had to pick maybe one or two, what are some other elements outside the mask fit or perhaps related to the mask or equipment that you think are really important when it comes to engagement?
I mean, I think it's that what I talked about before, how engaged is the patient himself, and then how skilled and available is the provider, and is the provider following up proactively when they see results that don't meet expectations. So being there for your patients, and not just available, but proactively reaching out when you're evaluating, you know, their performance and utilization, and see that it's not meeting sort of basic levels. So those would be the ones I would look at outside of fit. I think the machines are all, you know, very good at this point, and we don't see, you know, huge differentiation in performance or feedback on those. So that would be how I would look at that.
Okay. All right. Well, Gary, I have to say, on a completely unrelated matter, you're one of my favorite people to follow on Twitter. I love all your posts. That is great stuff. So anybody out there in the audience, make sure if you're on Twitter to follow him at GMSHEHAN. That's SHEHAN. Gary, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate
it. David, it was a great pleasure talking to you, and best of luck with the podcast series. It's an exciting sort of new development in the industry, and I hope it goes well.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Thanks.
Okay, that'll close things up for episode 9. Thanks again to Seth and Gary for sharing their time, information, and insights. If you want to stay on top of what's happening in the industry, make sure to check out hme-business.com and subscribe to our eSource weekly e-newsletter service there. And if you haven't done so, make sure to subscribe to the print magazine there as well. Again, that's hme-business.com. Of course, you can follow us on social media. We're at HME Business on both Facebook and Twitter, and I'm at Postacute News on Twitter. And of course, there's this podcast. Please, if you haven't already, make sure to click the subscribe button so that you get every new episode. Remember, you keep listening and we'll keep posting. Lastly, if you have any feedback, suggestions, or requests, don't be shy. All you have to do to reach out to me via Twitter is hit me up at @postacutenews, or you can email me at DKOPF. Again, that's DKO, P as in Paul, F as in Franklin, at 1105media.com. With that, I think we'll wrap things up for this episode. Thank you all very much for listening, and goodbye until the next HMEB podcast.